Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Daniel Lee, the author of Pétain's Jewish Children, French Jewish Youth and the Vichy Regime, 1940 to 1942. And the book was published by Oxford University Press in 2014. Hi there, Daniel.
Hi, Roxane.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
No problem. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm a very big fan.
I wonder if you could get us started by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in working on France.
Well, I grew up in London and I went to a regular high school. I had no connection at all with France. I just learned French at school. And my background was very much sort of just regular British history, the Nazis, Stalin, and very much never really thought anything much about French history, even as an undergraduate. And then one day I was at Sciences Po, where I was spending a year, and I took a class on Vichy France with Claire Andrieux. And that was really my first introduction to French history. I didn't know who Pétain was. I'd never heard of de Gaulle. And this class really got me thinking about France. And I found myself able to ask questions in a way that none of the other French students could possibly ask. Me, as the foreigner, it was just remarkable. And that's what really got me into thinking about this period.
So the subject of this book in particular, that was something that you were interested in right from the start when you became interested in France?
Yeah, as soon as I learned about French history, I knew that this was the period for me. It was the period that I was able to really get my teeth into and think about. And I was very, very lucky when I was applying for graduate programs. I got some excellent advice from Rod Kedwood. It was really him that put me on to thinking about some of the issues that I explore in the book. And then when I arrived at Oxford, I was very lucky to have so many people, so many other historians working in this area. So I worked with Robert Gilday, who was my main advisor. But then also we had people like Martin Conway, who's just a fountain of knowledge, as was Anne Simonin. So really, between the three of them, I was all set to go when it came to leaving Oxford and just delving into the archives.
Mm-hmm. So, Daniel, before we get into the argument that you're making, the arguments that you're making in the book, I wonder if you could, and I know this is a challenge, just give us a very brief overview of the Vichy period to sort of situate those of our listeners who may not be as familiar with its history.
The Vichy regime was founded really in the summer of 1940. France had lost a war to Germany and had paid a very, very heavy price for its defeat. It signed an armistice in the middle of June of that month, of that year. And what happened was France was divided really into two main zones, an occupied zone in the north, mm-hmm. which was really very much the same as anywhere else in Hitler's Europe. So there'd be signs in German, officers would be around, there'd be a visible German presence. Mm-hmm. Whereas what was known as the South or the non-occupied zone was by way of the terms of the armistice, technically a free zone. It was unoccupied. It was ruled from the spa town of Vichy. There were so many hotels in that town, so it was very simple, really, just for the government to take over all of these hotels and install the Ministry of Justice in one hotel, the Ministry of the Interior in another hotel. So France was really ruled from this town of Vichy, and it was led by, as many of your listeners will know, the Maréchal Pétain, who was a revered war hero from the First World War. And so between 1940 and 1944, France was ruled from Vichy by the Maréchal Pétain and his government.
Mm-hmm. So the book is framed by the years 1940 and 1942, and you've told us now about the defeat that accounts for the 40. So why 1942? What's the significance of that date in this history and for your book?
42 is a very, very important date in this period for a number of reasons. I think the obvious reason really is, of course, that the Germans, as soon as the British and the Americans liberated Morocco and Algeria in November 1942, the Germans immediately swooped down, and what was previously the non-occupied zone became occupied by the Germans. So from that point on, France essentially was occupied. But even if we go back from before November 1942, earlier on in that year, we see other important turning points, which are very significant in the context of Vichy and the Jews. So we see the return to power of Pierre Laval in April 1942. And from April 1942, with Laval, you have a real escalation in terms of collaboration with Nazi Germany. And then in August 1942, you have, for the very, very first time, the roundup of Jews in the southern zone, in the free zone. Mm-hmm. And this is really a huge turning point in the relationship between Vichy and its Jewish citizens at that time. So my book really ends there, because what I'm interested in, and I hope to be able to talk to you about today, is really things to do with coexistence and cooperation between Vichy and its Jews. Whereas I feel that beyond 42, and we're looking at 43, 44, such coexistence becomes almost impossible. Cooperation is no longer possible. What's interesting for me is the early years, where the ball is still up in the air between Vichy and the Jews. Nobody knows quite what way things are going to work out. Mm-hmm. Whereas after that point, people are scared. Jews are scared.
Mm-hmm. Throughout the book, Daniel, you're engaged with what seems to be a dominant set of themes and approaches to the history of French Jews under Vichy. So you identify these three main categories or modes in thinking about French Jewry during the period: persecution, resistance, and rescue. And these come up again and again throughout the book. And you're making an intervention with respect to these categories and ways of thinking about the period. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about those categories or those ways of thinking about Jews under Vichy and the existing scholarship on Vichy along these lines.
No, of course. That's an excellent question. I think that really this is a subject that has, you know, I'm not writing this subject from scratch, naturally. This is a conversation that I'm contributing to, hopefully with other scholars who have spent decades and entire careers thinking about Vichy and the Jews. So really what I'm trying to do is to think about some of the work that's been done before and how, whether or not there are other ways of interpreting these questions, because it seems to me that most of the existing scholarship has really been framed around this idea of persecution, in that naturally we know, of course, everybody knows that from October of 1940, legislation was in place that aimed deliberately to separate Jews from the rest of the French population. And this legislation escalated throughout the occupation. So from June 1941, more legislation was put in place. Jews were systematically filtered out from the civil service, from the liberal professions, etc. That's one way of looking at how we as historians have looked at this question through this prism of persecution. Other ways, which I've identified, are resistance. From the start, many Jews resisted, just like other segments of the population, in various ways, in the Gaullist resistance, in the communist resistance, in the Zionist resistance. Mm-hmm. Jews were very enthusiastic to get together to either fight with arms against the Nazis or Vichy, or just adopt other strategies. And that one, for me, would be rescue, the rescue of other Jews, the rescue of Jewish children. Many Jewish organizations, again, from the summer of 1940, were turned towards rescue as a strategy. Mm-hmm. Now, these three categories, persecution, resistance, and rescue, are, of course, entirely valid and necessary categories, naturally, when we're talking about 1942, 43, 44. Yet I feel that just through only looking at these categories, it is impossible sometimes for some stories and some historical events to come through. Mm-hmm. And I feel that if we start to look perhaps at cooperation, was it possible for Jews to cooperate with Vichy, for example? That by using these existing categories doesn't always allow for this possibility, if you would, of cooperation to shine through. So I try to look at this story very much through the ways in which Jews in France sought to cooperate with Vichy, and ways in which Vichy allowed Jews to cooperate in certain of its schemes for regeneration.
Mm-hmm. And I want to follow up on that, but just before I do, Daniel, I guess I want to ask you something I should have asked you from the outset, was how many people are we talking about? So what percentage of the French population in 1940, let's say, do Jews constitute?
Well, in 1940, there were about 40 million people living in France at the time. And of the 40 million population, we estimate, because of course there were, you know, in secular France, one would never have been asked one's religion, but we can estimate that there are approximately 330,000 Jews. And I think of these 330,000, we need to distinguish between those who had come to France fleeing persecution from Central and Eastern Europe during the 1920s and during the 1930s, who came in significant numbers, often fleeing Hitler and pogroms following the Russian Revolution. So I think really we're talking about a population of about 110,000 French Jews versus perhaps 200 or so thousand what would be known as foreign Jews, those without French citizenship. And, you know, these French Jews, these are Jews who are French citizens whose fathers had fought in World War One, whose grandfathers had fought in Franco-Prussia. Mm-hmm. These were Jews whose families had been in France for generations.
And you talk, to come back to what you were saying earlier, you talk about the significance of, you know, a previous emphasis in the scholarship on legislation, and you just brought this up a few moments ago. And your interest is on... I think you referred to it as the social relationship between Jews and the state. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Well, of course, we have to pay a lot of attention to the legislation. We can't simply ignore the decrees that were put out by Vichy and by the Germans for whatever reasons that aimed to discriminate against Jews. But I think immediately... upon entering the archives, and here I'm talking about the provincial archives, hundreds of miles away from Vichy, and really looking at documentation attesting to the relationship on the ground in the localities between Vichy and the Jews, we do get another story. We know that the legislation existed, and we know that it reached local prefects, sub-prefects, mayors, local civil servants in the localities. But the extent to which these laws were actually interpreted and even implemented requires, I think, a little bit considerable more scrutiny. That's where I think we see the improvisation of policy making at that time. Local individuals in a time of utter chaos in France. Let's not forget, you know, the defeat to Germany, 1.5 million men prisoners of war, the chaos caused by the exodus. It's in this context that a local official is receiving a letter from Vichy saying, how many Jews are there living in your locality? Or, this actually happened in June 1941. Every mayor was sent a telegram saying, how many Jews do you think there are? Not, you know, go and do a census. It was local mayors had to guess. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these mayors were so incredibly busy. They had all these other problems going on. Most, a great number of them had probably never even seen a Jew or even knew anything about a Jew. And they received this piece of paper from Vichy. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them often are having to just really... especially in this early period of the first few months of the regime, really have to like balance a lot of a lot of priorities. And that's really what a lot of my book is about, I think. Pétain's Just Children is really thinking about what our priorities were in this specific historical moment for individuals who are in charge of putting decisions in place.
Daniel, you begin the book with this sort of overview of French Jewry on the eve of Vichy, and you and I want to come back to the question of youth in a couple of moments, but you give us this kind of context for understanding what changes after 1940. And would you say that part of the argument of the book is that there is a great deal of continuity from those last years of the Third Republic into the period 40 to 42, or is 40 a watershed?
This is a huge historiographical question, and so many people. I mean, I know, of course, in your own work and in other people's work who are looking at the 1930s, they are trying to. Some people are trying to isolate the 30s or see to what extent the 30s led to Vichy or to, you know, going backwards, how far were the 1930s contributing to Vichy's? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think in terms of what I'm doing, I think it's very much. I am looking for continuities, of course. I am looking to, for example, I'm talking about how young Jews in France at that time sought to return to the land. They sought in the 1930s to leave Paris, to leave Strasbourg, and to go out into the countryside and to reinvent themselves as the new Jews, the new Jewish body that was going to really return to the land, return to agriculture, and to do something new. And so Vichy, when it came along, offered an opportunity to some of these ideas that already existed in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like so many other people, young Jews were taking opportunity in defeat from Vichy. Mm-hmm. And they are not so different to other elements of the population. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, on the one hand, there is this section of continuity. But on the other hand, there are some people who, because some doors might be closed to them because of Vichy legislation, all of a sudden are starting to look for other possibilities. So are doing new things that under the Third Republic, before the outbreak of war in 1939, they wouldn't have considered doing. Let's not forget, for example, that the Germans in September 1940 explicitly stated that Jews living in the non-occupied zone were not allowed to return to the north. They weren't allowed to come to Paris. Mm-hmm. So if you had fled Paris during the Exodus in 1940 and found yourself somewhere in the south, you were obliged to stay in the south. Mm-hmm. You had to reinvent yourself in whatever way that would be.
It's really interesting. And, you know, we've talked already a little bit about the fact that, you know, the book is focused on youth. So I guess I want to ask you about that. Why is the book focused on youth? What is it that looking at youth allowed you to do in terms of your research and in terms of pursuing these questions of accommodation and coexistence? Does the study of youth tell us something about the broader population, or is it very unique, I guess, to the issue of young people?
No, I mean, of course, youth, I think, is a fascinating category to think about when analyzing these questions that I'm interested in. You know, the question is, how far was it possible to coexist between Vichy and the Jews at that time? Of course, other categories I could have chosen or would make interesting analyses. You know, women, Jewish women, for example, Jewish women who were wives of prisoners of war. You know, as we know, if Jewish Jewish prisoners of war in Germany at that time, their pensions, their allowances would continue to be sent to their wives in France. Just because they were Jewish didn't mean that they would stop receiving their wives of prisoners of war allowance, for example. Similarly, cases exist, of course, of veterans. We know so much fascinating work is being done at the moment on veterans organization. There's a new book by Chris Millington from the 1930s. You know, Jewish veterans obviously were an extremely, in some ways, I suppose, controversial category at that time. Some of them joined the Vichy's Legion, Pétain's Legion. Some of the veterans, of course, received special exemptions from certain laws. So there are other categories which of Jews that definitely require further analysis. But I think youth, for me, was immediately the most fascinating because Vichy really privileged youth. Mm-hmm. It put youth at the center of everything it was trying to create. Let's not forget, it was the adults. It was the grown-ups. These were the people that had destroyed France and led her to defeat. Mm-hmm. You know, the youth, this was the future generation. These were the ones who were going to rebuild France and lead it forward. So the fact that youth were put on a pedestal, and the fact that young Jews were invited to contribute to this program immediately spoke to me and made me realize that there's something to really investigate further here.
You point to the ways that Vichy was plural in this period that you're looking at, and to ways in which the Jewish population in France is also not a monolith, right? And can't be understood in homogeneous terms, either before the war or certainly during the period that you're focused on in the book. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit about those pluralities, you know, what led you to those conclusions? And if you could give us a couple of examples, that would be great.
Yeah, of course. I mean, like, you know, and again, this isn't me, you know, I'm not in any way saying that I've created these categories, because of course, the idea of a plural Vichy is something that's existed from the 1970s. You know, Stanley Hoffman, Rod Kedwood were writing about it at that time. But I think people who have looked in the past at the idea of this plural Vichy, the idea that Vichy was not any one thing to any one person at any one time, the fact that it was constantly changing and evolving, and that in the summer of 1940, there was no blueprint. It's not as though, you know, France was defeated and all of a sudden you got a group of people together at Vichy who just mapped out a blueprint and thought, right, this is what we're going to do. Of course, that's not what happened. We know that. Loads of different people were coming to Vichy in the summer of 1940 with their plans for renewal and revival and regeneration, seeking these opportunities in defeat. Okay, some were traditionalists, mm-hmm. some were modernists. Lots of people who were trying to inspire Catholic ideas. Lots of people who were trying to do all sorts of things. This is what was going on in this plural space in Vichy. And I think that at the same time, Vichy reacted was reacting and evolving in multiple plural ways. And it did so as well insofar as its Jewish question was concerned. There was never, and I think this is one of the main points of Petain's Jewish Children, there was never one single, Vichy never spoke with one voice over the Jewish question.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it had people in charge who would be ministers for Jewish Jewish questions and what have you, but it would be preposterous to think that every single minister, the Minister of Agriculture, the Minister of Youth, the Minister of Interior, spoke, had the same opinion on Jews at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is really what I'm hoping to get across in my book, that people spoke with multiple. Some people were, of course, extremely anti-Semitic and thought that the Jews had brought all the evils to France, naturally, and sought to really place the Jews at the top of their lists of things that needed to be changed in France. Other people might have, again, seen some of these arguments and might occasionally have brought in the Jewish element in their policy making. Whereas for other people at Vichy, the Jews and the Jewish question was just not at all on the list of their priorities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, with the Minister of Agriculture, Pierre Cazaux, for him, the most important thing to do, given the debilitating situation of French agriculture at that time, with so many men being in Germany, with so many of France's most prized possessions in terms of agricultural stock and produce being sent to the north, being sent to Germany,
mm-hmm.
France's agriculture was on its knees. And so if you had a Jew who perhaps wanted to take over a piece of land, to work the land, to till the land, for the Minister of Agriculture, he didn't care if this person was Jewish. All that was important for him mm-hmm. was that the land got tilled.
Right.
So we have multiple examples, lots of evidence in the archive pointing to disagreements between the Ministry of Agriculture and the Ministry for Jewish Affairs over this question of prioritization. What's more important? Do we place agriculture first, or do we eliminate the Jews?
And Daniel, the book does a wonderful job, I think, of complicating any of those kinds of easy moves that we might want to make to think of the Vichy state as one, as being of one mind or one body on any of these issues. And you also make the point that when we look at, well, French Jews in general, but specifically Jewish youth in France, that the differences between different types of groups also plays a significant role in all of this. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that. You discuss groups that existed prior to Vichy, youth groups, scouting groups, and then also the ways in which young people were welcome to participate in things like the Chantier de Jeunesse under Vichy. So you really focus on these two case studies in the book, and I wonder if we could turn to those now, and if you could tell us a little bit about why these two case studies, some of the background on those two things and what you learned from focusing on these two.
Yeah. Well, I think, that's what I suppose the second half of the book is about. I really sort of go to town on these two examples. The first example is Lautrec. And the second example, like you said, is the Chantier de la Jeunesse. Mm-hmm. And so what I do in the Lautrec case is to focus. Now, Lautrec, as many of your listeners will know, is a small village in the southwest of France, in the département of the Tarn, about, I'm not sure, maybe 50 miles or so from Toulouse. It's to the east of Toulouse. It's this very isolated sort of hamlet. And what happened was you had a situation in the summer, autumn of 1940, when a number of young Jews who really, having reached adolescence in the late 1930s with these ideas of returning to the land, found themselves in the south of France and really sought this idea of let's use opportunity and defeat. We can see that Vichy is sort of giving out money to people wanting to take away land, take over abandoned land, etc. And these young Jewish scouts, the Éclaireurs Israélites de France, got together and set up a number of, I suppose, kibbutzim, for want of a better word, young, vibrant agricultural communes, mm-hmm. with Judaism very much at the heart. There was no way that Judaism was ever going to be disguised here. This was a central project to recreating the Jewish man and the Jewish woman in France at this time. This is something that was developed in the 30s and very much spilled over into Vichy. And so what happened was, I talk mainly about Lautrec because it was the biggest mm-hmm. of these centres. So in November 1940, one of the youth leaders of the Jewish Scouts went to the prefect of the town and was very explicit. You know, we want to create a Jewish kibbutz, a Jewish agricultural commune in your department. You know, this is at the same time as the Statut des Juifs. This is at the same time that Jews were being marginalized from the rest of the population gradually. You know, and mm-hmm. in this instance, for the prefect of the town, it's as I was suggesting before, it's very normal that agriculture should take precedence. And so what happened was immediately from the end of 1940, beginning of 1941, you had young Jews, about 20 of them were there at that original first few months. But then it got bigger and bigger over time. And it was Judaism was central to this idea. So in the mornings, there would be a lot of work going on to the land, lots of raising livestock. And, you know, this is all Vichy. Vichy was paying for most of this. Mm-hmm. This was Vichy money from various Vichy local or national ministries mm-hmm. that and was sending cattle or whatever. You know, and the cattle, for example, you know, they had two big cows, this particular one, both of which were named after two of their favorite Zionist villages in Mandate Palestine at the time. There was no way, there was no pretense that this was ever going to be anything that it wasn't. This was a young, vibrant, Jewish, Zionist community that was trying to invent itself under Vichy publicly, okay? Uh-huh. And religious life, spiritual life was very much at the heart. And of course there were like disagreements over Judaism. Some people were more wanted to observe things differently to others. And some people, were perhaps not into certain ways of Jewish thinking of others. But on the whole, we have a situation, but from 1940 until well into 1943, actually, that this commune continues to exist, that young Jews from across the non-occupied zone are telling their parents, we want to be at this kibbutz, we want to be at Lautrec, we want to work the land. There's no jobs for us in Limoges, we can't go to university, let's return to the land. Mm-hmm. And that's precisely what happens in this in this commune. So in one case study, I talk very much about that. And I'm building on the work of other historians who, of course, have looked at Lautrec in the past. But I think what I do, which is perhaps a little different here, is I went to Lautrec and I went to the local archives. And I was very much interested in seeing what the local community thought of the Jews. Mm-hmm. How did locals in the town, a part of France which had no Jewish population, of course, had no synagogue, how did these local people interpret this mass, this arrival en masse of young Jews from Paris, mm-hmm. Who dressed differently to them, who spoke differently to them, who could read, who could write, who all of a sudden were receiving rations that they weren't entitled to. Okay, what I do, which is a little different perhaps to other historians who've looked at this Lautrec, is really to try and piece together the two sides, if you would, the local population's attitude to the Jews, and also mm-hmm. the Jews using their own letters and diaries, many of which were preserved after the war. So that's, I suppose, one thing I was very, very interested in exploring. And then the other thing is, of course, the Chantier de la Jeunesse, which was a compulsory, I suppose, to even call it a youth movement would be very upsetting to many of its participants, who saw it more as an army service. You know, I did a lot of interviews with many of these elderly, who are now rather elderly, participants, well into their 90s now, actually. Mm-hmm. Who and especially, you know, Jews and non-Jews, of course, very much saw it as an 8-month spell of military service. The Germans had said when they in the armistice that France wasn't allowed its army, conscription was all of a sudden prohibited. I mean, it was allowed a small army, but that's neither here nor there. Official conscription was prevented, was stopped, and all of a sudden Vichy had a crisis. It thought to itself, gosh, you know, how are we going to be able to train all of our young men to protect France and turn into good civilians, citizens? So it introduced this system, this Chantier de la Jeunesse. So for 8 months, young French men on their 20th birthday would be sent away from their families to these chantiers spread all around the non-occupied zone to really become acquainted with old natural France, with the land, with manual labor, and with communal work. And Jews, like any other French citizen, had to take part in this obligatory system to rebuild France.
So, Daniel, you've talked a little bit about the interviews that you did, and so I guess this is as good a time as any to ask you about sort of your method and your sources. And I am interested in you saying a little bit more about all the different types of archival, you've mentioned a couple of them already, but all the different types of archival materials that you drew on to get at some of these questions. Mm. And I would love to hear you say more about, you know, the choices that you made in terms of the interviews that you did and what that experience was like as you were researching the book.
Yeah, oh, cool. Again, thank you. It's a privilege, actually, to talk about methods and sources. I think in terms of, well, given that what I'm really interested in, above all, is was getting across how the young Jews themselves negotiated their personal, private relationship with the regime, mm-hmm. it was really important to get to sources that spoke to this. And this was always hard. You know, in administrative archives, as I know you know, it's very, very hard to sometimes get the voices out of mm-hmm. the young people of those concerned. So this required me to do perhaps, it certainly required a lot of travel to archives, local archives, private collections, not just in France, but often a lot of people had, although they'd been in France for the Vichy years, after the war they'd migrated, like as people do. So there's a lot of people who had left France for Israel at various stages, sometimes immediately after the war, sometimes in the 1960s and 70s, and who had of course taken with them their private archives and of course their personal stories. So Israel, the United States, and I think often I knew that what I was looking, I was really interested in talking to people who were born really between 1919 and 1925, 26. Now, I was doing most of the research for this book around 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. So I knew from the start that it was going to be difficult, and I was racing against a clock. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of this project, I tried to do as much oral history as I could. And this would often be a case of trying to just locate people, putting ads in newspapers, speaking on local radio stations to try and get testimony, to try and get people to talk to me who might have participated in any of these youth movements, who might have been Jewish themselves or might have known Jews who took part in them. And then, as is often the case with oral history, naturally we have to, as anyone who does use oral history, you know, it's like any other source. We have to be very careful with our sources. We have to hold them up to the highest standards and interrogate them just like any other sources. But often oral history does lead to some fantastic things. And I don't just mean anecdotes and life and details about everyday life that other sources can't give. But it also does sometimes lead to the production of written sources, contemporary written sources. So I was very lucky that some of the people I was interviewing did keep with them written sources from the occupation. So a lot of, for example, letters that had been sent from the Chantier de la Jeunesse had been kept in the family's private collections, private archives. So I was very lucky to get, you know, on Monday, this is what I did, this is what I ate, on Tuesday I did this. You know, I was very lucky to get a day-by-day account of what was going on in these places at that time. So I was able to use the oral history alongside some of these written contemporary sources, which really opened whole new angles on the period. But, you know, together with these private archives, of course, I was very interested in of course, national archives in Paris, but then local archives. And this book couldn't have been written without the wonderful sources that I was finding, especially in departmental archives, in the Tarn, in the Tarn-et-Garonne, in the Haute-Garonne. Like, these are places where, it's a pleasure to work in such places, Roxanne. You have archivists who are just delighted to see you. All of a sudden, you know, you walk in and there's a lot of people who are there doing their genealogy projects, and all of a sudden they get a serious historian or scholar who wants to look at something and actually use their archives. So they're, you know, they're delighted to help you. So there's definitely a lot to be said, a lot to be said there. So again, I was also using a lot of interviews that were carried out by other people. Of course, I know that when I was doing this work, most of the people I was interested in were dead. We were talking about people in their very late 80s, early 90s. But fortunately, a lot of interviews were carried out during the 1960s and during the 1970s, many of which have been preserved. A lot are in Israel, at the Avraham Harman Institute for Contemporary Jewry at the Hebrew University. But even in the mid-1990s, the Steven Spielberg collections, his project to interview as many Holocaust survivors as possible. These were people who, in the mid-1990s, were in their early to mid-70s. And these are fully documented and are available at various institutions around the world. So I was very lucky to be able to draw on a wide, diverse range of sources to really get to the heart of some of these tough questions that I was asking.
You tracked in the book, well, you pursue this sort of idea that Jewish identity and French national identity weren't incompatible, at least in these early years of Vichy, as incompatible as someone who, you know, might have only received or read the work that focuses on, you know, persecution and resistance and rescue might conclude. And I wonder, you know, in the people in the interviews that you were able to conduct, I have other questions, like did some people not want to talk about this? Do those French Jews who are experienced the things that you talk about in the book, is there kind of an ambivalence about the period? Like, what sense do you get of the memory of Vichy ways in which people understand Vichy, given all of the literature that's now been produced and the things that have been revealed and all of that?
No, I think I was, in the sense that I was working on French Jews. This is a book that looks at young French Jews, so those with French citizenship, and that's an important distinction to make. You know, I'm not looking at Jews whose families had perhaps come to France, fleeing persecution in the 20s and 30s, possibly not speaking French, certainly not having citizenship. So, and Vichy, we know, made a distinction in the way it treated French Jews and foreign Jews. So we know, for example, that the first roundups of Jews in the non-occupied zone in August 1942 was solely of foreign Jews. Mm-hmm. And this is something that went on right until the end of 42, beginning of 1943. It's only at the beginning of 1943, really, in the south of France, that we begin to see Jews of French citizenship being taken away. And by the end of the occupation, you have a situation in which the majority of those deported from France were foreign Jews. Mm-hmm. And French Jews, of course, many were deported, but proportionally, they were not subject to the same sort of roundups and deportations as the foreign Jews. So given that I was working on this population, that I was working on those of long-standing French origin, I think this definitely affected my interviews and in a way that perhaps I think fewer people had siblings or parents or cousins or relatives that were deported than had I been working on foreign Jews in France at that time, or just Jews in general. I was, you know, the fact that I was working on specifically French definitely affected it. So some of the people I interviewed really see summer 1942 as a turning point. And before that time, I didn't come across anyone objecting to my hypotheses. Yes, their fathers might have lost their jobs in the civil service or in the liberal professions, but personally affecting them, their young people, other than the universities, which of course we know introduced quotas, etc. I was getting a sense from my interviewees and obviously from the contemporary correspondence that a lot of them didn't so much see any sort of the danger for them is something they spoke about gradually. It's something that the anti-Semitism, the marginalization, these are things that, you know, perhaps Jews in France had experienced before. You know, Stavisky was only a few years before, Dreyfus was at the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. You know, Jews in France, it's not the first time that there had been anti-Semitic outbursts. And a lot of the Jews at this time thought that the anti-Semitic laws that were being enacted were coming from Germans. A lot of them perhaps didn't know that these were French laws, as we, of course, know today and fully understand that these were entirely French. But this wasn't always obvious at the time. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I feel I'm digressing here from your question. So if I take, for example, one of my interviewees, who comes to mind only because he's on the front cover of my book, and which is staring at me in the face. He was a young man who was from Strasbourg and was in sort of a commercial business school at that time. He was 20 years old in Strasbourg. Mm-hmm. And then he left Strasbourg, went to the south of France, automatically used the opportunity, used 1940, 41, 42, to lead a life that he could never have lived before in Strasbourg. He didn't want to be in this commercial school, according to him. This is the kind of life his father had created for him. Mm. Vichy immediately put a lot of emphasis on perhaps performing arts, on music, on theatre, alongside some of the agricultural programs I've already discussed with you. So for this particular individual, he saw, okay, I'm in the south of France. I want to be a musician or an actor. This regime, whatever it is encouraging me to do this. Why wouldn't I take part in this? And so he joined the Jeune France movement. He joined the Comédien Routier and spent a lot of the time performing, most of 1941, performing all over the southern zone. What his particular troupe would do was you had the Minister of Youth, the Vichy Minister of Youth, Georges Lamiran, whose role it would be to go across France and to sort of give speeches to young, well, to anybody who would care to listen. You had stadia that were filled of young French people at that time. But before Georges Lamiran would take to the stage with Vichy's message, the Comédien Routier, this young, athletic troops would be sort of the warm-up act. They'd go and like sort of do a few skits, do some performances. And of this particular troop, of which there were 8 to 10 participants, two of the members were Jews. So one of the people who I've just mentioned, Georges Weill from Strasbourg, he was a young musician performer traveling around as the warm-up act for La Mirand, as was his friend Sylvain Adolphe, who again, and again, it's actually thanks to his son, who lives in Tahiti, who sent me this photograph that's actually on the front cover of my book. And I think this photograph actually, I mean, I know, I'm sorry to digress from your question, but this photograph is such a beautiful photograph. I mean,
it really is.
I was so lucky to have found it and so privileged that his son from Tahiti would send it to me. It's of four young men, 20 to 21 years old, who are standing with their arms crossed, looking very proud, standing in front of the Chateau de Uriage in November 1940. Mm-hmm. Now, Uriage, as many of your listeners will know, was this school that was set up by Vichy in the summer to autumn of 1940 to be really like the ENS, the training school where the elite of France, those that were going to build Vichy, those that were going to contribute and completely transform France, they were going to be the leaders of this school. They were going to go on the training courses there, and they were going to be the ones to make the decisions. And in November 1940, they asked for representatives of the Jewish scouts to come. They wanted the four, or, well, they wanted as many, I suppose, 4 to 6 of its best leaders to come and represent the Jewish scouts and take part at its training course at Uriage. And so Monsieur Weill, Sylvain Adolphe were sent to take part at this training school for the future leaders of Vichy, representing the Jewish scouts. On there, in the photograph, you can see that all four of them are wearing the badges of the Jewish scouts. They were completely open about their backgrounds and about what they were trying to do. But I mean, if we take one of the people in this picture, Henri Moscot, you know, this was a young man who again, he was taking part at this stage in a Vichy project, in a Jewish project, but then later on was eventually deported to Auschwitz and didn't come back in 1943. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I'm trying to get at in this book is that it's really Vichy and its relationship with the Jews is constantly changing. It's a gradual relationship. And just because people are getting deported in 1943-44, doesn't mean that they were the same as going on right at the very beginning. And that, I think, was very important. That's really one of the central messages of the book, this gradual process, and that nothing was inevitable. And just because one door is closing doesn't mean that all doors are closed to Jews.
Well, I guess I want to ask you about this, Daniel, because I wonder, you know, about the debate that you're, well, the possible debates that you're entering into by making these arguments. And I think, I'm sure there are people, and I can't think of who off the top of my head, but who would make the argument that Vichy is some kind of a culmination of a longstanding French anti-Semitism, that, you know, there are continuities post-Vichy in France, that there's a bigger history of French anti-Semitism, and Vichy is, you know, perhaps the most shameful episode in that longer history. And I wonder, how would you respond, I guess, to the notion that that the book is potentially making Vichy seem less bad, really, or less anti-Semitic, at least in its complication of some of these issues?
No, I mean, that's certainly not something that I was ever trying to get at in the book. The idea that Vichy wasn't a monstrous, horrendous regime that deported its Jews and sought to exclude its Jews from the rest of the population is something that can't be argued with. And that's nothing at all. There's no way, shape or form that I would ever even suggest such a thing. Of course, this was the case. All I'm saying is that I've, as a historian, like the rest of us, have asked some hypotheses that really are looking at some of the possible, not so much cracks, but even, you know, contradictions in Vichy's program for anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. and showing it not to be this cohesive whole, and that there's nothing wrong really with looking at instances in which some of these sometimes, to give an example, perhaps, I think, I spoke about, of course, the youth and the scouts and what have you having certain privileges, and then similarly for Jewish wives of prisoners of war. But then also you had many other situations in which Jews were not always discriminated against in a way that we would suspect. Mm-hmm. For example, in Nazi Germany, I just don't feel that anti-Semitism underpins the relationship between Vichy and the Jews in the way that it did in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. For example, there's a case, Richard Weisberg, the historian, has written about landlord-tenant relationships. You know, if a Jewish tenant is complaining about his or her landlord in the civil courts in Vichy, almost always the tenant would win when the cases came to court. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the fact that he or she was a Jew didn't matter. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Nazi Germany, you know, of course, such a thing would be unthinkable. You can't have a case of a Jewish tenant complaining about his or her landlord, mm-hmm. and the Jewish person winning. That wouldn't exist. Whereas Vichy doesn't always put anti-Semitism at the heart of its, mm-hmm. Not only of its policy making, but also of its sort of social construction, social interactions. Yes, we have legislation. Yes, we know there's propaganda. But I mean, honestly, I think a lot of the propaganda that we know about from Vichy at this time very much starts from the end of 1942, 43, 44. Mm-hmm. The propaganda, I know, you know, René Poznanski and others have seen propaganda coming from the southern zone, mm-hmm. as early as 1940, but even René Poznanski has talked about this being very much a hidden form of propaganda against mm-hmm. Jews, speaking about Jews metaphorically. And even so, propaganda that did exist, any propaganda that existed, very much did not place Jews at the heart of the problem about what was affecting France. Freemasons, Bolsheviks, Anglo-Saxons, these were the people that took up most of the Vichy propaganda at this time, not the Jews. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to suggest that Vichy wasn't an actor in the Holocaust is preposterous. Naturally, naturally, it was, and naturally, I think the cases of the 1990s of, Maurice Papon and Tuvier and Barbie and etc. These are all testimony to what was going on in this horrible period, especially after 1942, when coexistence between Jews and Vichy was no longer, according to me, viable.
Well, and you make the argument that that's not just because of what's coming from outside in terms of, you know, German efforts and orders, but that there are also these kind of internal things that were within the French Jewish communities and
yes,
within the Vichy state as well.
Exactly. Because, like I've suggested so far, is that, you know, reconstruction, the idea of rebuilding France in this horrendous climate, this is what took precedence for certain ministers mm-hmm. at Vichy over anti-Semitism. Obviously, you know, there was a ministry for Jewish affairs. This ministry, by the way, and many of your listeners will already know, Vichy passed its anti-Jewish legislation in October 1940. Okay, mm-hmm. This Jews could not be civil servants, etc. Yet there was no ministry set up to make sure that such legislation was even being put into place mm-hmm. Until the very end of March, beginning of April 1941. So you did have a period of several months in, okay, you had legislation in place, but who's going to be the one to actually go and knock on the doors and check that such legislation is being implemented?
Right.
So Vichy's anti-Semitism, it's certainly not uniform. And it's certainly not always filtering down to the localities. I mean, what I see in the Chantier de la Jeunesse, I mean, I found the most fantastic documents in Paris. I think I'm the only person to ever have looked at them. And what they are is individual dossier on anyone of every single person in the Chantier de la Jeunesse who had some form of responsibility, even like somebody whose job was to, just be in charge of two young comrades or whatever, would have had to have signed these forms. And so I've had thousands and thousands of forms. And what you see is that people were having to sign a form saying, I am not a Freemason, I am not a Jew, I have not been involved in X, Y, Z. And these forms were dated. And so what's amazing is that, you know, if Vichy is passing its laws at a certain date, one would suspect that people would be signing these forms, perhaps, in the days or weeks that followed. But on the contrary, in the Chantier de la Jeunesse, we see that sometimes, not only are such forms not even being signed, that sometimes they're signed maybe a year later or a year and a half later. Okay, so the fact that legislation is being put into place at Vichy does not mean that it always manages to filter down to the localities. I mean, I take your point that, working on this area, it is a sensitive area. Mm-hmm. People can, might interpret this the wrong way. But I think that, you know, from reading the book and from really looking at these questions that I'm trying to ask and hopefully answer, I would be very surprised if anybody thought that in any way I was trying to say that Vichy was not anti-Semitic. I feel all I'm doing really is just, like other historians who have seen diversity and pluralism at Vichy, I'm trying to contribute to that argument through the lens of, by bringing in the story of the Jews, which until now, it seems to me, hasn't been complicated as other areas have been.
Well, and it seems, I mean, I would agree with you. That would certainly be my reading of the book. I just sort of wanted to ask you about what you would think about that realm of debate. And it seems to me that the other thing that you're doing in the book that is really interesting in terms of your research is moving between the local and the national. And I think in that sense, the book not only tells us a great deal about Vichy and the Jews, but, you know, something, it's a case study in how states function and how the local and the national, you know, interact and are in tension with one another. So I learned, as someone who doesn't work on Vichy, I learned something from the book about the complexities of the relationship between local contexts and national contexts, particularly during a period where so much is at stake in terms of policy and legislation and how that filters down or not. So that was one of the other things that I gained from reading the book that I could see thinking about other periods and other issues through.
I mean, of course, we know that hindsight is a sure. wonderful thing. And we know that, it does, it's very easy to see Vichy and its relationship with the Jews as sort of this downward spiral of exclusion where things are just getting worse and worse. Mm-hmm. But I really hope that's not what I fundamentally believe that wasn't always the case in 40 to 42. Mm-hmm. I'm really trying to show that, especially for young Jews, they were constantly seeking new ways to really like reinvent their relationship with the regime. And that some options did remain open until 1942, after which point any sort of space for coexistence was really at an end. But until that time, I'm not saying anything was possible, because that's certainly not the case, but it was not impossible, shall we say, for some young Jews to make inroads with Vichy, and for Vichy to continue to allow its door to remain open.
Well, and it seems to me that in doing all of this work and in making these arguments, you're making, and you say this at the beginning of the book, you're making this tremendous contribution to the notion of Jewish agency under Vichy, right? That you're allowing for those possibilities and exploring the ways in which, you know, accommodation wasn't just about figuring a way around. It was also about people pursuing their own interests and in some, you know, dreams and pursuing things that were important to them. So these ideas of the return to the land or being able to kind of combine Zionist aims with things that were allowable under the terms of the Vichy state, all of these kinds of things. As you say, you're bringing particularly French Jewish youth and their agency into the story in a way that perhaps previous work hasn't done. Well, Daniel, I've taken up a lot of your time, and I have one last question for you, which is, what are you working on now?
no, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. I am now, well, a lot of what I was finding, especially in the national sources for this project, would constantly talk about things going on in North Africa at this time. And I was always so fascinated when I came across things to do with Jewish question in North Africa. And it just didn't seem relevant. Some of the questions, some of what I was finding, just I couldn't bring in North Africa to this project on Vichy and the Jews. The legislation was so different. The debates concerning citizenship was so different. I had to keep that separate. So now, finally, having finished this project on Vichy and Jewish youth in France in the non-occupied zone, I'm finally able to return to these documents and to really explore them a lot more. And so what I'm trying to do is really focus on Tunisia at this time. Unlike Algeria and Morocco, we have a very interesting situation at which when the Allies, the Brits and the Americans, liberated Algeria and Morocco, the Nazis swooped in and occupied Tunisia. And so you had a six-month Nazi occupation of Tunisia in which you had all sorts of horrendous legislation and interactions going on between Jews and the Nazi population. So this is something I'm working on right now.
Well, Daniel, I want to thank you so much for joining me and for writing this wonderful book.
Thank you very much, Roxanne.
You've been listening to New Books in French Studies. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us again next time.